least, he thought. Randall frowned a little, glancing from the dog tags to Roger's face, then back. He was clearly thinking the same thing Roger was. And if the charm is detached from the person it was meant to protect... But he didn't say anything, merely touched the green tag gently.
J.W., your son's name is Jeremiah, I understand.
Yes, Jeremiah is an old family name. It was my father's name.
He was interrupted by the entrance of Private MacDonald, a very young soldier, dripping wet and slightly blue with cold, who saluted Captain Randall smartly, then gave way to a rattling cough that shook his spindly frame. Once recovered, he complied at once with Randall's order to tell Roger all he knew about the dog tags, but he didn't know much. One of the soldiers, stationed at Riven Barracks, had won them in a dice game at a local pub. He did recall the name of the pub, the Fatted Grouse. He'd drunk there himself. And he thought the soldier had said he'd won the bawbee from a farmer come back from the market in Perth.
"Do you recall the name of the soldier who won them?"
Roger asked.
"Oh, aye, sir. 'Twas Sergeant Macklehose."
"And now I think..."
A broad grin at the recollection showed crooked teeth.
"I mind me of the farmer's name, too. 'Twas Mr. Anthony Cumberpatch. It did tickle Sergeant Macklehose being foreign and sounding like Cucumber Patch."
He sniggered, and Roger smiled himself. Captain Randall cleared his throat, and the sniggering stopped abruptly. Private MacDonald snapping to a sober attention.
"Thank you, Mr. MacDonald," Randall said dryly. "That will be all."
Private MacDonald, abashed, saluted and left. There was a moment's silence, during which Roger became aware of the rain, grown harder now, clattering like gravel on the large casement window. A chilly draught leaped around its frame and touched his face. Glancing at the window, he saw the drill yard below and the whipping post, a grim crucifix stark and solitary, black in the rain.
"Oh, God."
Carefully, he folded up the dog tags again and put them away in his pocket, then met Captain Randall's dark eyes directly.
"Did Captain Buncombe tell you, sir, that I'm a minister?"
Randall's brows rose in brief surprise.
"No, he didn't."
Randall was plainly wondering why Roger should mention this, but he was courteous.
"My younger brother is a clergyman. Church of England, of course."
There was the faintest implied question there, and Roger answered it with a smile.
"I'm a minister of the Church of Scotland myself, sir. But if I might, will you allow me to offer a blessing for the success of my kinsmen and myself, and in thanks for your kind help to us?"
Randall
blinked, clearly discomfited.
"I suppose so. All right."
He leaned back a little, looking wary, hands on his blotter. He was completely taken aback when Roger leaned forward and grasped both his hands firmly. Randall gave a start, but Roger held tight, eyes on the captain's.
"O Lord," he said, "we ask thy blessing on our works. Guide me and my kinsmen in our quest, and guide this man in his new office. May your light and presence be with us and with him, and your judgment and compassion ever on us. I commend him to your care. Amen."
His voice cracked on the last word, and he let go Randall's hands and coughed, looking away as he cleared his throat. Randall cleared his throat too, in embarrassment, but kept his poise.
"I thank you for your good wishes, Mr. Mackenzie. And I wish you good luck. And good day."
"The same to you, Captain,"
Roger said, rising.
"God be with you."
Chapter 46. Baby Jesus, tell me. Boston, November 15th, 1980. Dr. Joseph Abernathy pulled into his driveway, looking forward to a cold beer and a hot supper. The mailbox was full. He pulled out a handful of circulars and envelopes and went inside, tidily sorting them as he went.
Bill, bill, occupant, junk, junk, more junk, charity appeal, bill, idiot, bill, invitation, hi, sweetie.
He paused for a fragrant kiss from his wife, followed by a second sniff of her hair.
Oh, man, are we having brats and sauerkraut for dinner?
You are, his wife told him, neatly snagging her jacket from the hall tree with one hand and squeezing his buttock with the other. I'm going to a meeting with Marilyn. Be back by 9, if the rain doesn't make the traffic too bad. Anything good in the mail?
Nah, have fun.
She rolled her eyes at him and left before he could ask if she'd bought Bud. He tossed the half-sorted mail on the kitchen counter and opened the refrigerator to check. A gleaming red and white six-pack beckoned cheerily, and the warm air was so tangy with the smells of fried sausage and vinegar that he could taste it without even taking the lid off the pan sitting on the stove.
"A good woman is prized above rubies," he said, inhaling blissfully and pulling a can loose from its plastic ring.
He was halfway through the first plate of food and two-thirds of the way into his second beer when he put down the sports section of the Globe and saw the letter on top of the spilled pile of mail. He recognized Bree's handwriting at once. It was big and round, with a determined rightward slant, but there was something wrong with the letter. He picked it up, frowning a little, wondering why it looked strange, and then realized that the stamp was wrong. She wrote at least once a month, sending photos of the kids, telling him about her job, the farm. And the letters all had British stamps, purple and blue heads of Queen Elizabeth. This one had an American stamp. He slowly set down the letter as though it might explode and swallowed the rest of the beer in one gulp. Fortified, he set his jaw and picked it up.
"Tell me you and Rog took the kids to Disneyland, Bree," he murmured, licking mustard off his knife before using it to slit the envelope.
"She talked about doing that someday."
"Baby Jesus, tell me this is a photo of Jem shaking hands with Mickey Mouse."
Much to his relief, it was a photo of both children at Disneyland, beaming at the camera from Mickey Mouse's embrace, and he laughed out loud. Then he saw the tiny key that had fallen out of the envelope, the key to a bank's safe deposit box. He set down the photo, went and got another beer, and sat down deliberately to read the brief note enclosed with the photo.
"Dear Uncle Joe, I'm taking the kids to see Grandma and Grandpa. I don't know when we'll be back. Could you please see to things while we're gone?"
Instructions in the box.
"Thank you for everything. Always. I'll miss you. I love you. Bree."
He sat for a long time next to the cold grease congealing on his plate, looking at the bright, happy photo.
"Jesus, girl," he said softly. "What's happened? And what do you mean, you're taking the kids? Where the hell's Roger?"
Part 3. A Blade New Made from the Ashes of the Forge. Chapter 47. Something Suitable in Which to Go to War. June the 19th, 1778, Philadelphia. I woke completely disoriented to the splat of water dripping into a wooden bucket, the sharp smells of wood pulp and printer's ink, the softer musk of Jamie's body, and frying bacon, the clank of pewter plates, and the loud braying of a mule. The latter noise brought back memory at once, and I sat up, sheet clutched to my bosom. I was naked, and I was in the loft of Fergus's print shop. When we left King Sessing the day before, during a brief pause in the rain, we had found Fergus patiently sheltering in a tool shed near the gates, Clarence the mule and two horses tethered under its eaves. "You haven't been out here all this time?" I blurted upon seeing him.
"Did it take that long?" he inquired,
cocking a dark brow at Jamie and giving him the sort of knowing look that Frenchmen appear to be born with.
"Mm-hmm," Jamie replied ambiguously and took my arm. "I rode Clarence out last night, but I asked Fergus to come on a wee bit later with your horse for you. The mule canna carry us both, and my back willna stand walking that far."
"What's the matter with your back?" I asked, suspicious.
"Nothing that at night sleep in a good bed willna cure," he replied,
and stooping so I could put a foot in his hands, tossed me up into the saddle. It had been past dark when we made it back to the print shop. I'd sent Germaine at once to Jenny at number 17, with word where I was, but had gone to bed with Jamie before he came back. I wondered vaguely who else was at the house on Chestnut Street, and what they were doing. Was Hal still a captive, or had young Ian decided to release him? If not, had Hal assassinated Denny Hunter, or had Mrs. Figg shot him? Jamie had told me he'd left Ian in charge of the situation, or situations. There seemed to have been a great deal going on the day before. All of it seemed unreal and dreamlike, both the events I'd participated in and the ones Jamie had told me about on the ride back. The only vividly real recollection I had was of our conversation in the garden, and what followed it in the potting shed. My flesh still felt the echoes. Breakfast was plainly preparing below. Besides the delectable scent of frying bacon, I could smell toasted yeast bread and fresh honey. My stomach gave a loud gurgle at this, and as though the sound had caused it, the ladder, leading up into the loft, began to shake. Someone was coming up, moving slowly, and in case it wasn't Jamie, I seized my shift and pulled it hastily over my head. It wasn't. A pewter tray rose slowly into sight, laid with a plate piled with food, a bowl of porridge, and a pottery mug of something steaming. It couldn't be tea, and didn't smell like coffee. As the tray levitated, Henri Christian's beaming face appeared below it. He was balancing the thing on his head. I held my breath until he'd stepped off the ladder, and then, as he removed the tray from his head and presented it to me with a ceremonious little bow, applauded. "Merveilleux," I told him, and he grinned from ear to ear. "Félicité wanted to try," he told me proudly, "but she can't do it with a full tray yet. She spills." "Well, we can't have that." "Thank you, sweetheart." I leaned forward to kiss him. His dark, wavy hair smelled of wood smoke and ink, and took the mug. "What's this?" He looked at it dubiously and shrugged. "It's hot." "So it is." I cradled the mug in my hands. The loft had been warm the night before, the day's heat trapped under the roof, but it had rained most of the night, and the chilly damp had come through the holes in the roof. Four or five vessels placed under the leaks made a symphony of plinking sounds. "Where's grand-père?" Henri Christian's face at once went bright red. His lips pressed tight together, and he shook his head vigorously. "What?" I said, surprised. "Is it a secret? Don't you tell her!" Joni's shrill voice floated up from the shop below. "Grand-père said not to!" "Oh, a surprise, is it?" I asked, smiling. "Well, perhaps you'd best go down and help your mama, then, so you don't give it away by mistake." He giggled, hands pressed over his mouth, then reached up over his head, gave a convulsive leap, and flipped over backward, landing adroitly on his hands. He walked on them to the ladder, stocky little legs splayed to keep his balance, and for an instant my heart was in my mouth as he reached the edge, and I thought he might try to go down the ladder upside down. He flipped over again, though, landing neatly on the top rung, and scampered out of sight like a squirrel, giggling all the way down. Smiling, I plumped up the sparse bedding. We had slept on a flattened pallet of worn straw from the stable, which smelled rather strongly of Clarence, and on our half-dried cloaks, covered with a spare sheet and a ragged blanket, though Joni and Félicité had given us one of their feather pillows, they sharing the other, and sat back against the wall, the tray perched on a keg of ink powder. I was surrounded by stacks of paper, these shielded by oilcloth from the leaks. Some of it was blank reams awaiting the press, some of it pamphlets, circulars, posters, or the guts of unbound books awaiting delivery to customers or to the bookbinder. I could hear Missali's voice below, back in the living quarters behind the shop, raised in maternal command. No male voices but Henri Christian's, though. Fergus and Germaine must have gone out with Clarence the mule to make the morning deliveries of L'Oignon, the satirical newspaper started by Fergus and Missali in North Carolina. Normally, L'Oignon was a weekly paper, but there was a copy on my tray of the special edition for today, with a large cartoon on the first page showing the British Army as a horde of cockroaches fleeing Philadelphia with tattered flags dragging behind them and trailing ribbon banners filled with speeches of futile threat. A large buckled shoe labelled General Washington was squashing some of the more laggard roaches. There was a large glob of opaque yellow-white honey melting slowly in the middle of the porridge. I stirred it in, poured a bit of cream over it, and settled down to enjoy breakfast in bed, along with an article noting the imminent entrance into Philadelphia of General Arnold, who was taking office as the military governor of the city, welcoming him and praising his military record and gallant exploits at Saratoga. How long? I thought then, setting down the paper with a small shiver. When? I had the feeling that it had been, would be, much later in the war when circumstance turned Benedict Arnold from patriot to traitor. But I didn't know. It didn't matter, I told myself firmly. I couldn't change it. And long before that happened, we would be safely back on the ridge, rebuilding our house and our lives. Jamie was alive. Everything would be all right. The bell over the shop door below rang, and there was an excited gabble as the children stamped out of the kitchen. The soft rumble of Jamie's voice floated up over the confusion of shrill greetings, and I caught Masali's voice among them, stunned. "Duh! What have you done?" Alarmed, I scrambled out of my nest and went on hands and knees to the edge of the loft to look down. Jamie stood in the middle of the shop, surrounded by admiring children, his loose hair spangled with raindrops, cloak folded over his arm, dressed in the dark blue and buff of a Continental officer. "Jesus H. Roosevelt Christ!" I exclaimed. He looked up, and his eyes met mine like those of a guilty puppy.
"I'm sorry, Sassenach," he said apologetically. "I had to."
He'd come up to the loft and pulled the ladder up behind him to prevent the children coming up. I was dressing quickly, or trying to, as he told me about Dan Morgan, about Washington and the other Continental generals, about the coming battle.
"Sassenach, I had to," he said again softly. "I'm that sorry."
"I know," I said. "I know you did." My lips were stiff. I'm sorry, too. I was trying to fasten the dozen tiny buttons that closed the bodice of my gown, but my hands shook so badly that I couldn't even grasp them. I stopped trying and dug my hairbrush out of the bag he'd brought me from the Chestnut Street house. He made a small sound in his throat and took it out of my hand. He threw it onto our makeshift couch and put his arms around me, holding me tight with my face buried in his chest. The cloth of his new uniform smelled of fresh indigo, walnut hulls, and fuller's earth. It felt strange and stiff against my face. I couldn't stop shaking.
"Talk to me, Anian," he whispered into my tangled hair. "I'm afraid, and I didn't want to feel so very much alone just now. Speak to me."
"Why has it always got to be you?" I blurted into his chest. That made him laugh, a little shakily, and I realized that all the trembling wasn't coming from me.
"It's no just me," he said, and stroked my hair. "There are 1,000 other men readying themselves today. More, who didn't want to do it either.
I know, I said again.
My breathing was a little steadier.
I know.
I turned my face to the side in order to breathe, and all of a sudden began to cry, quite without warning.
I'm sorry, I gasped. I don't want to make it harder for you. I owed Jamie when I knew you were alive. I wanted so much to go home. To go home with you.
His arms tightened hard round me. He didn't speak, and I knew it was because he couldn't.
So did I, he whispered at last. And we will, Ian. I promise you.
The sounds from below floated up around us. The sounds of children running back and forth between the shop and the kitchen. Masali singing to herself in Gaelic as she made fresh ink for the press from varnish and lamp black. The door opened, and cool, rainy air blew in with Fergus and Germaine, adding their voices to the cheerful confusion. We stood wrapped in each other's arms, taking comfort from our family below, yearning for the others we might never see again. At once, at home, and homeless, balanced on a knife edge of danger and uncertainty. But together.
You're not going off to war without me, I said firmly, straightening up and sniffing.
Don't even think about it.
I wouldn't dream of it,
he assured me gravely, went to wipe his nose on his uniform sleeve, thought better of it, and stopped, looking at me helplessly. I laughed, tremulous, but it was a laugh nonetheless, and gave him the handkerchief I tucked automatically into my bosom when I fastened my stays. Like Jenny, I always had one. Sit down, I said, swallowing as I picked up the hairbrush. I'll pat your hair for you. He'd washed it this morning. It was clean and damp, the soft red strands cool in my hands and smelling, oddly, of French soap, scented with bergamot. I rather missed the scent of sweat and cabbage that had surrounded me all night. Where did you bathe? I asked curiously.
At the house on Chestnut Street, he answered, a little tersely. My sister made me. She said I couldn't turn up to be a general smelling like a stale dinner, and there was a tub and hot water to spare.
Did she? I murmured. Speaking of Chestnut Street, how is His Grace the Duke of Parlow?
Gone before dawn, Jenny said,
he said, bending his head to aid in the plaiting. His neck was warm under my fingers.
According to Ian, Denny Hunter said he was well enough to go, provided he took along a flask of your magic potion. So Mrs. Fig gave him back his breeches, with some reluctance, I understand. And he went.
Went where? I asked. His hair was more heavily traced with silver than it had been. I didn't mind that. I minded that I hadn't been there to see it slowly change, day by day.
Ian didn't ask him, but he said Mrs. Fig told the Duke the names of some friends of Lord John's, loyalists, that might be still in the city. And his son's staying in a house here, no? Dinna be worried on his account, Sassenach.
He turned his head to smile sideways at me.
His Grace is a man who's hard to kill.
I suppose it takes one to know one, I said tartly. I didn't ask why Jamie had gone to Chestnut Street. Hal, Jenny, and all other concerns notwithstanding, I knew he wanted to know whether John had reappeared. Apparently not, and a small chill frosted my heart. I was groping in my pocket for a ribbon with which to club his queue when a fresh draught swept through the loft, lifting the oilcloth and fluttering the papers beneath. I turned to see the source of the breeze, and beheld Germaine swinging off the pulley rope to come in by the shuttered doors through which bales and kegs could be lowered from the loft to wagons below.
"Bonjour, grand-père,"
he said, wiping a cobweb off his face as he landed and bowing to Jamie with great formality. He turned and bowed to me as well.
"Comment ça va, grand-mère?"
"Fer," I began automatically, but was interrupted by Jamie.
No,
he said definitely.
You're not coming.
Please, Granda.
Germaine's formality disappeared in an instant, replaced by pleading.
I could be helped to you.
I know, Jamie said dryly, and your parents would never forgive me if you were. I dinna even want to know what your notion of help involves, but...
I could carry messages. I can ride. You ken that. You taught me yourself. And I'm nearly 12.
You ken how dangerous that is. If a British sharpshooter didn't take you out of the saddle, someone from the militia would club you over the head to steal the horse.
And I can count, Ken.
You're no even 11 yet, so dinna be trying it on with me.
Obviously, danger held no fears whatever for Germaine. He shrugged, impatient.
Well, I could be an orderly then. I can find food anywhere,
he added, cunning. He was, in fact, a very accomplished scrounger, and I looked at him thoughtfully. Jamie intercepted my glance and glowered at me.
Dinna even think about it, Sassenach. He'd be taken up for theft and hanged or flogged within an inch of his life, and I couldn't do a thing to stop it.
Nobody's ever caught me,
Germaine said, his professional pride outraged.
Not once.
And they're not going to,
his grandfather assured him, fixing him with a steely eye.
When you're 16, maybe.
Oh, aye. Granny Janet says you were 8 when you first went raiding with your da.
Lifting cattle's no the same as war, and I wasn't anywhere near the fighting, Jamie said. And your Granny Janet should keep her mouth shut.
Aye, I'll tell her you said so, Germaine retorted, disgruntled. She says you got bashed on the head with a sword.
I did, and with luck you'll live to be an old man with your brains unscrambled, unlike your grandsire. Leave us, lad. Your granny needs to put her stockings on.
He stood up, and lifting the ladder, slid it down from the loft, and pushed Germaine firmly onto it. He stood looking sternly down until Germaine had reached the floor below, marking his displeasure by skipping the last few rungs and landing with a loud thud. Jamie sighed, straightened up, and stretched himself gingerly, groaning a little.
"God knows where we'll sleep tonight, Sassenach," he remarked, glancing at our rude couch as he sat down for me to finish clubbing his hair. "For the sake of my back, I hope it's a bit softer than this."
He grinned at me suddenly.
"Did you sleep well?"
"Never better," I assured him, smoothing out the ribbon. In fact, I ached in almost every place it was possible to ache, save perhaps the top of my head. For that matter, I'd barely slept, and neither had he. We'd passed the hours of darkness in slow and wordless exploration, finding again each other's body, and, toward dawn, had touched each other's soul again. I touched the back of his neck now, gently, and his hand rose to mine. I felt simultaneously wonderful and wretched, and didn't know from moment to moment which feeling was uppermost. "When will we leave?"
"As soon as you put your stockings on, Sassenach, and tidy your hair. And do up your buttons," he added, turning and catching sight of my excessive décolletage. "Here, I'll do that."
"I'll need my medicine box," I said, going cross-eyed as I watched his nimble fingers flicking down my chest.
"I brought it,"
he assured me, and frowned a bit, eyes intent on a recalcitrant button.
"It's a bonny bit of furniture. I expect his lordship bought it for you."
"He did." I hesitated a moment, rather wishing he had said John rather than his lordship. I also wished I knew where John was, and that he was all right. But this didn't seem the moment to say any of those things. Jamie leaned forward and kissed the top of my breast, his breath warm on my skin.
"I dinna ken whether I'll have a bed at all tonight," he said, straightening up. "But whether it's feathers or straw, promise you'll share it with me."
"Always," I said, and picking up my cloak, shook it out, swirled it round my shoulders, and smiled bravely at him. Let's go, then. Jenny had sent my medicine chest from Chestnut Street, and with it the large parcel of herbs from King Sessing, which had been delivered there the night before. With the forethought of a Scottish housewife, she'd also included a pound of oatmeal, a twist of salt, a package of bacon, 4 apples, and 6 clean handkerchiefs. Also a neat roll of fabric with a brief note, which read, "Dear Sister Claire, you appear to own nothing suitable in which to go to war. I suggest you borrow Marsali's printing apron for the time being, and here are 2 of my flannel petticoats, and the simplest things Mrs. Fig could find amongst your wardrobe. Take care of my brother, and tell him his stockings need darning, because he won't notice until he's worn holes in the heel and given himself blisters. Your good sister, Janet Murray."
"And just how is it that you own something suitable in which to go to war?" I asked, eyeing Jamie in his indigo splendour. His uniform appeared to be complete, from coat with epaulettes and a brigadier general's insignia to buff waistcoat and cream silk stockings. Tall and straight, with auburn hair neatly clubbed and ribboned in black, he distinctly drew the eye. He drew his chin back and looked down his nose at himself.
"Well, the sack and small clothes were mine already. I had them when I came from Scotland. But when I came back to Philadelphia to find you yesterday, I found Jenny first, and I told her about General Washington and asked her would she see to it. So she took my measurements and found a tailor and his son, who do uniforms, and browbeat them into working all night to make the coat and waistcoat. Poor wretches," he added, gingerly pulling a loose thread from the edge of his cuff. "How is it that you don't, Sassenach? Does his lordship think it unseemly for you to doctor folk and make you burn your working clothes?"
This was said with a sort of jesting tone that's meant to suggest perfect innocence on the part of the speaker, while making it perfectly apparent that malice is intended.
"I don't say that I'll no make a fuss about it later."
I looked pointedly at a medical chest John had given me, then back at him, narrowing my eyes ever so slightly. "No," I said with great casualness. "I spilled vitriol on them making ether." The memory made my hand shake slightly, and I had to set down the cup of nettle tea I was drinking.
"Jesus, Sassenach!"
Jamie spoke under his breath. Félicité and Joan were kneeling at his feet, arguing with each other as they busily burnished his brass shoe buckles. But he met my eyes over their heads, appalled.
"Tell me you weren't doing that drunk."
I took a deep breath, at once reliving the experience and trying not to. Standing in the hot, semi-dark shed behind the house, the rounded glass slick in my sweating hands. Then the flying liquid, it had barely missed my face. And the sickly smell and magically widening, smoking holes that burned straight through my heavy canvas apron and the skirt beneath. I hadn't really cared at the time whether I lived or died, until it looked as though I was going to die in the next few seconds. That made rather a difference. It hadn't convinced me not to commit suicide, but the shock of the near accident did make me think more carefully about how. Slitting one's wrists was one thing. Dying in slow, disfiguring agony was another. "No, I wasn't," I said, and taking up the cup, managed a deliberate mouthful. It was a hot day. My hands were sweating, and the flask slept. He closed his eyes briefly, all too clearly envisioning the scene himself, then reached across Félicité's sleek, dark head to cup my cheek.
"Dinna be doing that again, aye?"
he said softly.
"Don't make it any more."
To be honest, the thought of making ether again made my palms sweat. It wasn't chemically difficult, but it was terribly dangerous. One wrong move, a little too much vitriol, a few degrees of heat too much. And Jamie knew as well as I did just how explosive the stuff was.
I could see the memory of flames in his eyes, the big house going up around us.
I swallowed.
I don't want to, I said honestly, but without it, Jamie, I can't do things that I can do with it. If I hadn't had it, Aidan would be dead. So would John's nephew, Henry.
He compressed his lips and looked as though he considered that Henry Gray might be disposable. But he was fond of little Aidan McCullum Higgins, whose appendix I'd removed on the ridge with the assistance of my first batch of ether.
"Granny has to help people feel better, grand-père," Joni said reproachfully, rising from her spot at Jamie's feet and frowning up at him. "It's her calling, Mam says. She can't just not."
"I ken that fine," he assured her, "but she needn't have blew herself to kingdom come doing it. After all, who's going to look after all the sick folk if your granny's lying about in pieces?"
Félicité and Joni both thought that image hilarious. I was less amused, but didn't say anything further until they'd taken their rags and vinegar back to the kitchen. We were left in the sleeping part of the living quarters, assembling our bags and bundles for departure, and momentarily alone.
"You said you were afraid," I said quietly, eyes on the spools of coarse thread and twists of silk floss I was stowing in a wooden box with several suture needles. "But that won't stop you doing what you think you have to do, will it? I'm afraid for you, and that certainly won't stop you either."
I was careful to speak without bitterness, but he was as sensitive to tones of voice this morning as I was. He paused for a moment, regarding his shining shoe buckles, then lifted his head and looked at me straight.
"Do you think that because you told me the rebels will win, I am free to walk away?"
"I... no."
I slid the box lid shut with a snick, not looking at it. I couldn't look away from him. His face was still, but his eyes held mine intent.
"I know you have to.
I know it's part of what you are. You can't stand aside and still be what you are." That was more or less my point about... He interrupted me, stepping forward and seizing me by the wrist.
"And what is it that you think I am, Sassenach?"
"A bloody man, that's what." I pulled loose and turned away, but he put a hand on my shoulder and turned me back to face him.
I am a bloody man," he said,
and the faintest trace of rue touched his mouth, but his eyes were blue and steady.
"You've made your peace with what I am, you think. But I think you dinna ken what that means. To be what I am doesna mean only that I'll spill my own blood when I must. It means I must sacrifice other men to the ends of my own cause. Not only those I kill as enemies, but those I hold as friends. Or as kin."
His hand dropped away, and the tension left his shoulders. He turned toward the door, saying,
"Come when you're ready, Sassenach."
I stood there for an instant, blinking, then ran after him, leaving my half-packed bag behind. "Jamie!" He was standing in the print shop, Henri Christian in his arms, bidding goodbye to the girls and Massali. Germaine was nowhere in sight, doubtless sulking. Jamie looked up, startled, then smiled at me.
"I wasn't going to leave you behind, Sassenach. And I didn't mean to hurry you either. Do you?"
"I know. I just... I have to tell you something." All the little heads turned toward me like a nestful of baby birds, soft pink mouths open in curiosity. It occurred to me that I might better have waited until we were on the road, but it had seemed urgent that I tell him now, not only to relieve his anxieties, but to make him know I did understand. "It's William," I blurted, and Jamie's face clouded for an instant, like a breathed-on mirror. Yes, I had understood. "Come to me, Avalach," Massali said, taking Henri Christian from Jamie and setting him on the floor. "Oof, you weigh more than I do, wee man. Come away now, lassies. Grandad isn't going just yet.
Help me fetch out Granny's things.
The children obediently scampered off behind her, though still looking back at us in frustrated curiosity. Children hate secrets, unless they're the ones keeping them. I glanced after them, then turned back to Jamie. I didn't know if they knew about William. I suppose Massali and Fergus do, since...
Since Jenny told them. Aye, they do.
He rolled his eyes in brief resignation, then fixed them on my face.
What is it, Sassnach?
He can't fight, I said, letting out a half-held breath. It doesn't matter what the British Army is about to do. William was paroled after Saratoga. He's a conventioner. You know about the Convention Army?
I do.
He took my hand and squeezed it.
You mean he's not allowed to take up arms unless he's been exchanged? And he hasn't been, is that it?
That's it. Nobody can be exchanged until the King and the Congress come to some agreement about it. His face was suddenly vivid with relief, and I was relieved to see it. John's been trying to have him exchanged for months, but there isn't any way of doing it. I dismissed Congress and the King with a wave of my free hand and smiled up at him.
You won't have to face him on a battlefield.
Tank do year,
he said, closing his eyes for an instant.
I've been thinking for days when I wasn't a fretting about you, Sassnach,
he added, opening his eyes and looking down his nose at me.
The third time's the charm, and that would be an evil charm indeed.
Third time, I said. What do you... Would you let go my fingers? They've gone numb.
Oh,
he said. He kissed them gently and let go.
Aye, sorry, Sassnach. I meant, I've shot at the lad twice in his life so far, and missed him by no more than an inch each time. If it should happen again, you cannot always tell in battle, and accidents do happen. I was dreaming during the night, and... Och, nae matter.
He waved off the dreams and turned away, but I put a hand on his arm to stop him. I knew his dreams, and I'd heard him moan the night before, fighting them. Culloden, I said softly. Has it come back again? I actually hoped it was Culloden, and not Wentworth. He woke from the Wentworth dreams, sweating and rigid, and couldn't bear to be touched. Last night he hadn't waked, but had jerked and moaned until I'd got my arms around him, and he quieted, trembling in his sleep, head butted hard into my chest. He shrugged a little and touched my face.
It's never left, Sassnach,
he said just as softly.
It never will. But I sleep easier by your side.
Chapter 48. Just for the fun of it. It was a perfectly ordinary red brick building. Modest. No pediments, no carved stone lintels, but solid. Ian looked at it warily. The home of Philadelphia Yearly Meeting, the weightiest meeting of the Society of Friends in the Americas.
Aye, very solid.
Will this be like the Vatican? He asked Rachel. Or more like an archbishop's palace?
She snorted. Does it look like any sort of palace to thee? She spoke normally, but he could see the pulse beat quick in the soft spot just beneath her ear.
It looks like a bank,
he said, and that made her laugh. She cut it short, though, glancing over her shoulder as though afraid someone might come out and scold her for it.
What are they doing there? He asked, curious. Is it a great meeting house?
It is, she said. But there is also business to be done, thee knows. The yearly meetings deal with matters of... I suppose thee would call it principle. We call it faith and practice. There are books, rewritten every so often, to reflect the present sense of the meeting. And queries.
She smiled suddenly, and his heart gave a small extra thump.
I think thee would recognize the queries. They're much like thee has described the examination of conscience before thy confession.
Och, aye,
he said agreeably, but declined to pursue the subject. He hadn't been to confession in some years, and didn't feel sufficiently wicked at present to trouble about it.
This faith and practice, is that where they say you mustn't join the Continental Army, even if you didn't take up arms?
He was immediately sorry he'd asked. The question dimmed the light in her eyes, but only momentarily. She drew a deep breath through her nose and looked up at him.
No, that would be an opinion, a formal opinion. Friends talk over every possible point of consideration before they give an opinion, whether it's a positive one or not.
There was the barest hesitation before not, but he heard it, and reaching out, pulled out her hatpin, gently straightened her straw hat, which had slid a little askew, and pushed the pin back in.
And if, in the end, it's not, and we cannot find a meeting that will have us, lass, what will we do?
Her lips pressed together, but she met his eyes straight on.
Friends are not married by their meeting, or by priest or preacher. They marry each other. And we will marry each other, she swallowed. Somehow.
The small bubbles of misgiving that had been rising through his wame all morning began to pop, and he put a hand over his mouth to stifle a belch. Being nervous took him in the innards. He'd not been able to eat breakfast. He turned a little away from politeness and spied two figures coming round the far corner.
Och, there's your brother now, and looking guy fine for a Quaker too.
Denzel was dressed in the uniform of a Continental soldier, and looked self-conscious as a hunting dog with a bow tied round its neck. Ian suppressed his amusement, though, merely nodding as his future brother-in-law drew to a stop before them. Denny's betrothed had no such compunctions.
"Is he not beautiful?"
Dotty crowed, standing back a little to admire him. Denzel coughed and pushed his spectacles up his nose. He was a tidy man, not over-tall, but broad in the shoulder and strong in the forearm. He did look fine in his uniform, Ian thought, and said so.
"I will try not to let my appearance engorge my vanity," Denzel said dryly. "Is thee not also to be a soldier, Ian?"
Ian shook his head, smiling.
"Nay, Denny, I shouldn't be any kind of soldier, but I'm a decent scout."
He saw Denzel's eyes fix on his face, tracing the double line of tattooed dots that looped across both cheekbones.
"I expect thee would be."
A certain tenseness in Denny's shoulders relaxed.
"Scouts are not required to kill the enemy, are they?"
"No." "We've our choice about it," Ian assured him, straight-faced. "We can kill them if we like, but just for the fun of it, Ken. It doesn't really count." Denzel blinked for an instant at that, but Rachel and Dotty both laughed, and he reluctantly smiled.
"Thee is late, Denny,"
Rachel said as the public clock struck 10.
"Was Henry in difficulty?"
For Denzel and Dotty had gone to take farewell of Dotty's brother, Henry, still convalescent from the surgery Denny and Ian's Auntie Claire had done.
"Thee might say so," Dotty said, "but not from any physical ill."
The look of amusement faded from her face, though a faint gleam still lingered in her eyes.
"He is in love with Mercy Woodcock."
"His landlady? Love's no usually a fatal condition, is it?"
Ian asked, raising one brow.
"Not if thy name is neither Montague nor Capulet," Denny said. "The difficulty is that while Mercy loves him in return, she may or may not still have a husband living."
"And until she finds out he's dead," Dotty added, lifting one slim shoulder.
"Or alive," Denny said, giving her a look. "There is always the possibility."
"Not much of one," Dotty replied bluntly. Friend Claire, doctored a man called Walter Woodcock, who'd been badly wounded at Ticonderoga, and she said he was near death then and taken prisoner.
She stumbled slightly on the last word, and Ian was reminded suddenly that her eldest brother, Benjamin, was a prisoner of war. Denzel saw the cloud cross her face and gently took her hand in his.
"Both thy brothers will survive their trials," he said,
and warmth touched his eyes behind the glass.
So will we, Dorothea. Men have died from time to time, and worms have eaten them. But not for love.
Mm-hmm, said Dotty, but gave him a small, grudging smile. All right, then. Go ahead. There's such a lot to do before we go. To Ian's surprise, Denzel nodded, took a folded sheaf of papers from his bosom, and, turning, went up the step to the door of the meeting house.
Ian had supposed the place was only a convenient spot to meet.
He would be catching up his uncle and Auntie Claire on the road to Coriel's Ferry, but had lingered to help with the loading, for Denny, Dotty and Rachel were driving a wagon filled with medical supplies, but evidently Denny had business with Philadelphia yearly meeting. Was he seeking advice in how to be married as a Quaker, even while flouting their, what would you call it, edict? No, Rachel had said it was an opinion, but a weighty opinion, regarding support of the rebellion.
He's giving them his witness, his testimony, Dotty said matter-of-factly, seeing the puzzlement in Ian's face. He wrote it all out. Why he thinks it's right to do what he's doing. He's going to give it to the clerk of the yearly meeting and request that his views be mentioned and discussed.
Do you think they will?
Oh, yes, Rachel said. They may disagree with him, but they won't stifle him.
And good luck to them if they thought to try, she added, half under her breath.
She pulled a handkerchief out of her bosom, very white against the soft brown of her skin, and patted tiny droplets of sweat away from her temples. Ian felt a sudden and profound longing for her, and glanced involuntarily toward the clock tower. He'd need to be on the road soon, and hoped there'd be time for a precious hour alone with Rachel first. Dorothea's eyes were still fixed on the door through which Denny had passed.
"He is so lovely," she said softly, as though to herself,
then glanced self-consciously at Rachel.
"He felt badly for wearing his uniform to see Henry," she said, a tone of apology in her voice. "But the time was so short."
"Was thy brother upset?" Rachel asked sympathetically.
Dotty's brows drew down.
"Well, he didn't like it," she said frankly. "But it's not as though he didn't know that we're rebels. I told him some time ago."
Her expression relaxed a little.
"And he is my brother. He won't disown me."
Ian wondered whether the same was true of her father, but didn't ask. She hadn't mentioned the Duke. He wasn't really attending to Dotty's family concerns, though. His mind was busy with the thought of the coming battle and all that needed to be done immediately. Ian caught Rachel's eye and smiled, and she smiled back, all worry melting from her face as she met his gaze. He had concerns himself, certainly, annoyances and worries. At the bottom of his soul, though, was the solid weight of Rachel's love, and what she had said, the words gleaming like a gold coin at the bottom of a murky well.
"We will marry each other."
Chapter 49 Uncertainty Principle. As Jamie explained to me on the way out of Philadelphia, the problem lay not in finding the British, but in catching up to them with enough men and materiel to do some good.
They left with several hundred wagons and a very large number of loyalists who didn't feel quite safe in Philadelphia. Clinton cannot be protecting them and fighting at the same time. He must make all the speed he can, which means he must travel by the most direct road.
I suppose he can't very well be legging it cross-country, I agreed.
Have you, meaning General Washington, got any idea how big a force he has?
He lifted one shoulder and waved off a large horsefly with his hat.
Maybe 10,000 men, maybe more. Fergus and Germain watched them assemble to march out, but you ken it's not easy to judge numbers when they're crawling out of the side streets and all.
Hmm. And, how many men do we have? Saying we gave me an odd sensation that rippled through my lower body. Something between tail-curling apprehension and an excitement that was startlingly close to sexual. It wasn't that I'd never felt the strange euphoria of war before, but it had been a very long time. I'd forgotten.
Fewer than the British, Jamie said, matter-of-fact. But we will not ken how many until the militia have gathered. And pray it's not too late when we do.
He glanced aside at me, and I could see him wondering whether to say something further. He didn't speak, though, just gave a little shrug, and settled himself in the saddle, putting on his hat again. What? I said, tilting my head to peer up at him from under the brim of my own broad straw. You were about to ask me something?
I was. But then I realised that if you did know anything about what might happen in the next few days, you'd surely have told me.
I would. In fact, I didn't know whether to regret my lack of knowledge or not. Looking back at those instances where I'd thought I knew the future, I hadn't known nearly enough. Out of nowhere, I thought of Frank and Black Jack Randall, and my hands gripped the reins so strongly that my mare jerked her head with a startled snort. Jamie looked round, startled too, but I waved a hand and leaned forward to pat the horse's neck in apology. Horsefly, I said in explanation. My heart was thumping noticeably against the placket of my stays, but I took several deep breaths to quiet it. I wasn't about to mention my sudden thought to Jamie, but it hadn't left me. I'd thought I knew that Jack Randall was Frank's 5 times great-grandfather. His name was right there, on the genealogical chart that Frank had shown me many times. And in fact, he was Frank's ancestor, on paper. It was Jack's younger brother, though, who had sired Frank's bloodline, but then had died before being able to marry his pregnant lover. Jack had married Mary Hawkins at his brother's request, and thus given his name and legitimacy to her child. So many gory details didn't show up on those tidy genealogical charts, I thought. Brianna was Frank's daughter on paper, and by love. But the long knife-blade nose and glowing hair of the man beside me showed whose blood ran through her veins. But I'd thought I knew. And because of that false knowledge, I'd prevented Jamie killing Jack Randall in Paris, fearing that if he did, Frank might never be born. What if he had killed Randall then, I wondered, looking at Jamie sidelong. He sat tall, straight in the saddle, deep in thought, but with an air now of anticipation. The dread of the morning that had gripped us both had gone. Anything might have happened. A number of things might not. Randall wouldn't have abused Fergus. Jamie wouldn't have fought a duel with him in the Bois de Boulogne. Perhaps I wouldn't have miscarried our first child, our daughter, Faith. Likely I would have. Miscarriage was usually physiological in basis, not emotional, however romantic novels painted it. But the memory of loss was forever linked to that duel in the Bois de Boulogne. I shoved the memories firmly aside, turning my mind away from the half-known past to the complete mystery of the waiting future. But just before the images blinked out, I caught the edge of a flying thought. What about the child? The child born to Mary Hawkins and Alexander Randall, Frank's true ancestor. He was, in all probability, alive now. Right now. The ripple I'd experienced before came back, this time running from my tailbone up my spine. Dennis. The name floated up from the parchment of a genealogical chart, calligraphic letters that purported to capture a fact while hiding nearly everything. I knew his name was Dennis, and he was, so far as I knew, actually Frank's 4 times great-grandfather. And that was all I knew. Likely all I ever would know. I fervently hoped so. I wished Dennis Randall silently well and turned my mind to other things. Chapter 50 The Good Shepherd 12 bloody miles The train of baggage wagons stretched as far as the eye could see in either direction and raised a cloud of dust that nearly obscured the mules negotiating a bend in the road half a mile away. The people trudging beside the wagons on either side were coated with the fine brown stuff, and so was William, though he kept as much distance as he could from the slow-moving cavalcade. It was mid-afternoon of a hot day, and they'd been on the march since before dawn. He paused to slap dust from the skirts of his coat and take a mouthful of tin-tasting water from his canteen. Hundreds of refugees, thousands of camp followers, all with packs and bundles and handcarts, with here and there a laden horse or mule that had somehow escaped the army teamster's rapacity, were strung over the 12 miles between the two main bodies of the army. They spread out in a straggling mass that reminded him of the plague of locusts from the Bible. Was that the book of Exodus? Couldn't recall, but it seemed apposite. Some of them looked over their shoulders now and then. He wondered if it was fear of pursuit, or thoughts of what they'd left behind. The city itself was long out of sight. Well, if there was any danger of turning to a pillar of salt, it would be owing to sweat, not yearning, he thought, wiping his sleeve across his face for the 1000th time. He was himself eager to shake the dust of Philadelphia from his boots and never think of it again. If it weren't for Arabella Jane, he'd likely have forgotten it already. He certainly wanted to forget everything else that had happened in the last few days. He twitched his reins and nudged his horse back toward the trudging horde. It could be worse. Nearly had been much worse. He'd come close to being dispatched back to England, or sent north to join the other conventioners in Massachusetts. Thank Christ that Papa, that is, Lord John, he corrected himself firmly, had made him learn German, along with French, Italian, Latin, and Greek. Besides the divisions commanded by Sir Henry and Lord Cornwallis, the army included a huge body of mercenary troops under General von Knyphausen, nearly all of them from Hesse Cassel, whose dialect William could manage with no trouble. It had still taken a good deal of persuasion, but in the end he'd landed up as one of Clinton's 1000 aides-de-camp, charged with the tedious chore of riding up and down the ponderously moving column, collecting reports, delivering dispatches, and dealing with any small difficulties that developed en route, a more or less hourly occurrence. He kept a running mental note of where the various surgeons and hospital orderlies were. He lived in horror of having to attend the delivery of one of the camp followers' babies. There were at least 50 very pregnant women with the column. Maybe it was the proximity of these ladies, gravid and pale, their swollen bellies borne like burdens, balanced with the ones on their backs, that made him think of... Surely whores knew how to avoid pregnancy. He didn't recall Arabella Jane doing anything, but he wouldn't have noticed, drunk as he was. William thought of her whenever he touched the spot on his breast where his gorget should be. If asked, he would have said he'd put the thing on with his uniform and forgot about it. But from the number of times he found Arabella Jane in his mind, he was apparently in the habit of fiddling with it constantly. The loss of the gorget had cost him an unpleasant 5-minute analysis of his character, dress, hygiene, and personal failings from Clinton's chief aide, Captain Duncan Drummond, and a 10-shilling fine for being out of proper uniform. He didn't grudge her the cost. He did find himself keeping an eye out for Captain Harkness. He couldn't recall enough of their encounter to have any idea of Harkness's regiment, but there weren't that many dragoon companies with the present army. He was working his way back along the column now, doing his daily round on Visigoth, a big bay gelding with good wind.